and welcome to another episode of Lid Radio Podcast. I am your host for today, Francesca, and for this episode, we have author Neil Francis. Neil Francis is the author of Positive Thinking, The Entrepreneur's Book, and Changing Course. He is currently the chairman of a digital agency, Pogo Studio, director of a software company, trustee of Chest, Heart and Stroke Scotland, and trustee of Sporting Memories. At the age of 41, he suffered a stroke that led him to discover a new, meaningful and rewarding life, which led to Neil to publish 4 books and work with inspiring CEOs, leaders, charity bosses and entrepreneurs. Neil's latest book is Inspired Thinking, How to Discover New Ideas for Meaningful Success. Inspired thinking is an innovative way of discovering new ideas to achieve meaningful success. When someone or something inspires you, it pushes you and propels you to do something new or different. It gives you new ideas and a strong feeling of enthusiasm and excitement. And this is the key point of the book. It helps you discover inspiration from new ideas and insights, which will lead you on a journey of discovery, meaning, enjoyment, and purpose. So Neil, I want to unpack the title a little bit, how to discover new ideas for meaningful success. I mean, you've put meaningful in there for a reason. So why is it important to you, the book and those reading it?
So, yeah, well, thanks, Francesca. The word success, I think, means different things to different people, but majority of people would see success is around kind of material things like money or property. And I think that is very dangerous because the American psychologist, economics and author Daniel Kahneman and his co-founders were part of a fascinating team that from Princeton University who conducted a study entitled "Would You Be Happier If You're Richer? A Focusing Illusion." The team found that although people with high incomes are more likely to say to others that they are generally happy with their lives, this difference virtually disappears when they make a moment-to-moment assessment of how happy they really are. The study that they did, that study, was published in Science magazine, and their findings described a phenomenon known as focusing illusion, which misleads people into believing that money can or does make them happier. The more narrower an individual focuses on a particular aspect of our lives, the greater its apparent influence. When people consider the impact of any single factor on their well-being, not only income, they are prone to exaggerate its importance, says Kahneman and his team. So when survey responders asked, for example, whether wealthier people are happier than those less well off, they focus only on the financial status at the root of happiness, perhaps seduced by thoughts of big TVs, seaside resorts. They make too much of wealth can have on one's well-being. In reality, according to the study, higher income does little to improve life satisfaction. This focusing illusion can lead to a misallocation of time, from accepting lengthy commutes to sacrificing time spent socializing. Indeed, in the results of a national survey the authors analyzed, people with an income above 100,000 reported spending more time at work and commuting. This might help to explain why so many people with relative high incomes reported in a survey that they're generally happy in their lives, but don't actually experience as much happiness in their daily lives as they say they do. People do not know how happy or satisfied they are, the author writes. Overcoming the focusing illusion is key to help you discover meaningful success. It will enable you to avoid making stupid decisions. When you compare things like cars, careers, holidays, destinations, you tend to focus on one aspect particularly closely, neglecting the hundreds of others. You assign this one significant small thing because of the focusing illusion. Think about other purchases you've made. For example, the house you bought. The initial delight of having your offer accepted gradually wanes over time as daily events involving managing the house take over. For example, costly expenditure such as mending the roof, painting the rooms, and sorting out the gardens, there is a net loss of happiness when you really examine and think about it. Same with technology, same with holiday homes. Importantly, all of these things can distract you from finding sources of inspiration. How can you spend your time doing things that would definitely benefit your life from these resources when your thoughts are consumed by purchasing material goods? You're conned into the illusion that these will make you happy, but actually all the evidence shows they do not. Everyone overestimates the importance of material purchases, including me, on their well-being and underestimates the impact of experiences. Experiences like watching a great film, reading a book, going out for dinner with your family, or going on a long walk with your dogs. Yes, some experiences require money, but these activities are far better investments that will help you to find sources of inspiration and meaning in your life rather than buying a new top-of-the-range car. So when I talk about success, I don't mean material success, even though that could be a byproduct. I mean things that give you purpose, meaning, and fulfillment.
I see what you mean. I guess the focusing illusion is kind of the best marketing ploy as well then, really. Encouraging you to buy more from these companies to make you happier is kind of a great way for them to make money. It doesn't actually really work.
Yeah, totally. I absolutely fall by it. And, you know, how much time do you spend? The process of buying a car, I just find it the most stressful thing in the world. You know, because you've got to go to different garages and then you get into the discussion with the salespeople and you've got to make all these choices, very stupid ones, you know, about the wheels you'll have and all this. And you think this is going to make you really, really happy. I think there's lots of evidence that says the process of buying does give you happiness, but there is no correlation between when you're driving your car and your happiness. It just doesn't work, you know. You're not going to be more happier driving a BMW than an old 10-year-old car. And again, there's lots of evidence in that. Yeah, there's a brilliant book, Francesca, called The Art of the Good Life by Rolf Dobilai. And basically, there's a fascinating study that just shows that the type of car that you purchase has absolutely no bearing with your happiness when you're driving that car. Yes, it will give you happiness when you're purchasing to buy your BMW and, you know, you're looking at the magazines and, you know, for some people it's a great thing to test the car. But actually, when you start using it, there's no correlation because you might be driving the car and you're very stressful because you're late for meetings, or you might be in a country road, but there's no correlation between you driving a BMW and driving a 10-year-old car with levels of your happiness.
Yeah, that's really interesting because that's not what we all believe, really, is it?
Yeah, and I said I fall for that. Don't worry. We've all done it. But if you do actually think how much of your life you're focusing on things that really are not that important, you're looking forward to that holiday, you know, can't wait to go on that holiday, you know, in a year's time. And you consume all your life and think, when I get to that holiday, it'd be brilliant. Yeah. But there's lots of other things going on around your world that if you just lift your head up from, then that's what I mean, whether going for nice meals or big walks or all that sort of stuff. They're the things that really give you meaningful and long life happiness.
Definitely. I mean, you've mentioned it a few times, but I want to talk to you a bit more about the importance of inspiration. You go into some detail in the book about the difference between motivation and inspiration how it's linked to your passion. Can you explain a bit more about it?
Yeah, absolutely. Because I think it's very important because there is a big difference between inspiration and motivation because they have very distinct different meanings, but they are frequently interchanged in their usage. So inspiration is something that you feel on the inside? Well, motivation is something that really comes from the outside that compels you to do action. Basically, inspiration is a driving force while motivation is a pulling force. Inspiration, in the main, lasts longer than motivation. Motivation will get you through the workday or help you to achieve a specific goal, but it won't last a lifetime. Inspiration, on the other hand, is enduring. It can extend for a very long period of time, influencing all aspects of your life. The word inspiration, it really comes from passion. Motivation does not. Typically, when you're motivated to do something, you simply want to achieve that goal or that objective and then move on. Motivation in the moment can seem powerful, but its power is faded compared to the brilliance that is inspiration. Inspiration and passion are very close linked together. You can be motivated without being passionate, but you rarely see inspiration without passion close by. So what exactly is passion, inspiration? And when we think about it or talk about it, what do we actually mean when we feel, God, I feel really inspired, or that really inspired me? Well, when you have that feeling of inspiration, there is a surge of energy with a thrilling feeling of elevation and excitement. The senses are amplified and you are far more aware of the possibilities that seems to be opening up for you. You enter into this thing called flow. And when you experience flow, you lose track of time. You don't feel self-conscious, instead feel that what you're doing is intrinsically rewarding and you find enjoyable. It feels that you have been provided with some new perception, a new way of seeing things. This leads into a burst of energy, and true inspiration gives us motivation to take action. The word actually comes from Latin, meaning to breathe into, to rise the sense of possibilities in others. Then the one who is inspired eventually performs their own feats and inspires others, and so on down the line. Finding inspiration from either a person or a team, a sports team, a piece of art, a scientific solution, or nature brings with it a wave of energy that by itself can propel you to do things that you might have thought were possible. It is so important because it keeps the mind positive and focuses on the big picture. The psychologist, Scott Kaufman from the University of Columbia, highlighted in his article, Why Inspiration Matters, for the Harvard Business Review. He basically said, in the culture obsessed with measuring talent and ability, we often overlook the important role of inspiration. Inspiration awakens us to new possibilities by allowing us to transcend our ordinary experiences and limitations. Inspiration propels a person from apathy to possibility and transforms the way we receive our own capabilities. Two other psychologists, a guy called Todd Thrash and Andrew Elliott, they identified three elements which occur when we're inspired. We see new possibilities, we're receptive to outside influence, and we feel energized and motivated. The great news is inspiration is not a static state of mind, but a process that can be cultivated. While we can't force ourselves to be inspired, what we can do is create an environment that helps people to become inspired. And in this book, Inspired Thinking, that's the environment I'm trying to create in it.
Yeah, it's actually really interesting how often we cross over motivation and inspiration, but actually how different they really are.
Yeah, I mean, I was talking to a guy that played international rugby, you know, and a great example is that, you know, before you're getting out, you know, the kind of the captain is yelling at you and says, we're going to go out, we're really motivated, whatever. Yeah. But an inspirational talk is something that will stay with you for the rest of your life. So maybe it's the day before the big game, or maybe 3 hours, you sit down in a calm place and the coach gives you a talk that is so inspiring that you says, right, you know, I'm doing this for my parents or whatever. Yeah, he's really inspired me. And that's what the difference is, just if you look at it from a sporting point of view.
Yeah, definitely. I guess inspiration, motivation is kind of the after step after you've been inspired. But yeah, I see.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, the first part of the book is about kind of laying the foundation to find inspiration. And we've kind of been through that and gone over the importance of it. But I want to look a bit more into the second part of the book, which is about the barriers that can come in our way, and specifically about the blind self. So is this, I'm guessing, quite a common obstacle to stop inspired thinking, and what is it?
Yeah, I think this is one of the key messages in the book, because when somebody told me about the blind self, it had a huge change in my life. And we're talking back about 15 years ago when I was on a course. So basically, let me explain with some scientific evidence about when I'm talking about the blind self. So in 1955, the American psychologists, Joseph Luft and Harrington Ingram, developed a model to help people better understand their relationships with themselves and others. They called it Johara's window, from a combination of their names. So it's it. Or then in 2000, the author, Charles Handy, developed a leadership and management tool based on the model called Johari's House, which aim is to basically develop self-awareness. Handy believed that in order to develop self-awareness, you need to be aware not only of how you see yourself, but crucially, how others see you. And so the Johari's House is Handy's analogy for a person. And he developed a model that can be applied to you, me, or anyone to help them become more self-aware. So within this house, there are four rooms, each representing four parts of any individual. So that's you, me, or anybody, okay? So room one is the part of you that both you and others see, the open self. For example, you might be incredibly organized. You focus on timelines and deadlines. You set up routines, and you are disciplined. You know that, and everybody around you knows that. That is one of your core strengths. Room two, though, is a room that contains the parts of you that only others see. Yeah, you're unaware of them. Now, this is a blind self, and I'll come back to it in a minute. In room three is the unconscious part of you, which is seen neither by you or by others, the unknown self. This is the part that traditional psychologists like to talk about, Freud's. Room four is your private space, the part that you know but keeps from others, the hidden self. This is a room where you keep your most intimate thoughts, the things you would not tell anyone else about. But let's go back to room two, because for me, it is the most fascinating room in the Johari's House, as it has the potential to block you from discovering new sources of inspiration. Fundamentally, your blind self contains aspects of your behavior and responsibility, personality, sorry, that can either hold you back or propel you forward. In the brilliant book, Fearless Leadership, she identifies eight behavioral blind spots that can stop you becoming the best you can do. Just see if you can recognize some of these that you think you have. Having a I know attitude. You think that you're right, that you're always right. You judge others not by their intentions, but by their actions. You always try to avoid conflict and stressful situations, and therefore avoid conversations when that can happen. Going it alone. You do things without asking others for their input because you feel you need to get things done on your own. This can also include not accepting help from others and not including others in decisions. Blaming others or circumstances. You avoid the need to have accountability or try to negate by shifting blame. You're always having a reason, excuse, or explanation for why something went wrong. You don't stick to your commitments. You regularly show up late for meetings, or you do not get projects done on time. You constantly use the words, I try rather than I will. So it's things like that. There's lots of others that she talks about, but these are the things, they are behaviors that you can't see, but other people can see. And the question is, how do you make that room smaller? Because if you're doing behaviors which you're unaware of doing, then that's going to stop your ability to grow as an individual and to find other areas of inspiration. Basically, to make your room smaller, accept that you, like everyone else, have blind spots, and that's absolutely normal. So everybody has them. I have them, Francesca, you have them, people listening to this have them. You then need to find someone you really trust and then surround yourself with them and diverse thinkers. Take the time to examine how you've behaved in a variety of situations, and crucially, recognize your triggers. The outcome of all of this is that slowly your blind self starts to become more self-aware on how you act and react to a wide range of challenges and circumstances. This will help you as you find new sources of inspiration all around. So that to me is just a crucial thing. And I think it is, because you can't see it yourself, you're going to trust people to say, you know, do I take advice from you? And you'll probably find out that they'll say, no, you're the complete opposite of that, because you've got your blind self and you're not letting people to give you advice where you're probably making mistakes.
Yeah, I think everyone listening can probably, I recognize some in myself that I probably need to start addressing as well. But it's really interesting to hear. I mean, talking more about the inspiration, the final part of the book, it covers a whole host of different stimulus points that you can get inspiration from. Are there any that stick out to you as being like a good starting point, or any that you've personally found particularly helpful?
Yeah, obviously there's lots of things that kind of stand out in the book, I think. But I think the one which I would advise people to always remember when they're looking for new ways of inspiration is based on this story here that's in the book, and then why it's such an important story for me. So I want to tell you a story, okay, based on three people. So on the 26th of November in 1983 in California, an industrial paper salesman and a mathematics teacher had a son, and they called him Chris. On 14th of May, 1984, in New York, a dentist and a psychiatrist had a son called Mark. 8 days later on, in May, in Florida, a psychiatrist and a teacher had a son called Dustin. 18 years on, Chris, Mark, and Dustin have finalized their first year at Harvard University and are about to start their second year. And another part of the university, an accommodation officer, runs a computer program that allocates these students to their rooms. The printer jumps into life and prints out the list showing which students are allocated to which rooms. The accommodation officer then takes the printed sheets for the various dorms and houses and gave them to a member of the staff to pin the list on the notice board of the relevant dorm. During the day, all the second year students arrives, and Chris, Mark, and Dustin find out that they're going to be living together at Kirkland House. These three people are Chris Hughes, Mark Zuckerberg, and Dustin Moskovich, who later founded Facebook. That computer program that randomly put Hughes, Moskovich, and Zuckerberg together helped start one of the biggest companies in the world today. In that room, a chemistry was created by these three people, which created the ideas around building social medium. Because they were allocated room H33, today all three are now billionaires. They have changed the way in the way that we all communicate and share details of our lives. They've inspired so many of the entrepreneurs. So it would be easy to conclude that the core of their success was their effort, talent, skill, and hard work. But is that the whole picture? Is there something else more fundamental? Well, Hughes hints what this could be in his book, Fair Shot. But he says this, and I think it's just absolutely fascinating. He says, saying people get lucky is not a denial that they work hard and deserve positive outcomes. It is a way of acknowledging that in a winner-take-all economy, small changes in counters, like who you sit next to at a dinner party or who your college roommate is, have a far more significant impact than they have ever had before. In some cases, these collections of these small differences can add up to create immense fortunes. So just think what Hughes was saying. He's basically saying that what seems like small random events or chance encounters can end up having the most significant impact of your life. Let me ask you a question, Francesca. You know, how successful do you think you've been so far in your life? I don't mean success. I don't just mean about how much you've earned or how senior role you've had in an organization. There are other success indicators you should consider. So, for example, how many qualifications have you achieved? Are you currently employed? Do you have a secure job? Do you have free time to do the things you enjoy doing? Now, I guess, and I won't embarrass you, but I guess you would probably say, yeah, some of those apply to me. And therefore, I would say, well, you've been successful. Yeah. And I would say the majority of people would be able to answer, I'd say, yeah. But then, and I'll ask myself this rather than you, because I don't want to embarrass you. Then I want you to ask this additional question, and I'm asking this to you and everybody. How much of the success you and all the listeners and me have had so far in your life can you attribute to your own actions, to your own efforts, work and input? And how much is down to chance? Factors that are beyond your control, like who you sit down at a table or someone you meet on a plane. If I ask myself, probably about 55% is my own achievement and 45% to factors beyond my control. But just let's think about this for a moment. At its core, is it not 100% to factors beyond my control? Think about Hughes and Zuckerberg. If that computer program had not placed these three individuals in room H33, Facebook may never have been founded. My bet is that they would not be as wealthy and successful as they are now. Warren Buffett, the investor, calls this the ovarian lottery. He says this, okay? The truth is, I'm in my position as a matter of luck, thinking how wealthy he is, okay? When I was born in the 1930s, odds were probably 40 to 1 against me being born in the United States. I did win the ovarian lottery on that day, and on top of that, I was male. Put that down as another 50-50 shot, and now the odds of 80 to 1 against being born a male in the United States. And it was enormously important to think that makes me superior to anyone else as a human being is just rubbish. Yes, I just can't follow that reasoning, he said. At the core of Buff's extraordinary success is the fact that he was born in the USA as a white man. Basically, he was incredibly lucky. Let's have a look at it from a different point of view and use me as an example for someone who's benefited from this lottery. None of the following were my choices. I was born in England, one of the wealthiest countries in the world. I went to a primary school where I was taught to read. Today, there are about 760 million adults in the world who are illiterate. That is more than the population of Europe, or one in every 10 people, because I could read. I was able to get a good education from a variety of schools. 264 million children do not get the chance to go to school. Because I got a good education, I was able to take exams, I was able to go to college. In the developing world, less than 3% of the population go into tertiary education. That's education for people above school age. I could go on about all my jobs, the person I married, and the children we had. But hopefully you get my point. Like Buffett, I am incredibly lucky. Lucky to be born in the 20th century, and lucky that my income allows me to be in the top 1% of income earners in the world. If you have an annual income of over 25,000, then you're also in that bracket. Like Buffett, many of the things I've achieved so far in my life are down to luck. So, given all that, what proportion of the success you and all the people listening to this have achieved so far in my life can be ascribed to your own achievement? Well, if you strip it back, it's zero. I hate to bust your bubble and everybody else's if you feel your successes have been achieved by hard work or determination. These are the byproducts of the fact that your successes are fundamentally based on things over which you have no control whatsoever. Basically, you haven't really earned achievements. The more you start to understand, accept that any success that you have achieved so far in your life at its core has been down to luck, then you realize the consequences of any further success will still have luck at the core. So who knows who you'll meet over the next week, month, over the coming years that will change the direction of your life in a way that you could not even envisage today. And that, to me, is the most inspiring thing that you can think. It is at the core of the book that you will find inspiration because you're lucky. You'll be in the right situation at the right time, but you'll be inspired to do certain things. So that's basically it.
Yeah, but it's kind of a mind-boggling concept when you think about it. And I think that's probably like a good place to end, to give everyone some thinking space about how, I guess, lucky they have been and how much of it has been down to them. It's quite interesting to think about.
Yeah. I mean, when the opportunity, you know, is presented to you, like they did with the Facebook boys, you've got a huge amount of work to do, you know. But the point is that, you know, it's luck that you were in this place at the right time. And then you've got to really grasp it and go for it, you know. And that's the inspiring bit. That's the most important thing, you know, that you've got to, whatever luck you get, that's the starting point. That's when the hard work begins. But the fact that you've been given this opportunity, to me, that's it. That's where the inspiration is, you know, that... that just to drive you to new things.
Yeah, and how you use it, definitely.
Yeah.
Brilliant. I mean, lastly, for anyone that's interested for knowing more about you and the book, where can they find you?
You can find me on my website, which is www.neil-francis.com, or you can email me at neil@neil-francis.com.
Okay, brilliant. And the book is Inspired Thinking, just as a reminder for everyone, which will be in the show notes for everyone to click on and go and have a look.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Neil.
No problem, Francesca.
Neil, thank you so much for joining us today, and thank you everyone for listening. Don't forget to keep an eye on our social media at Lid Publishing on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram for information about new books, experts' opinions and more podcasts with experts such as Neil Francis. See you next time on Lid Radio Podcast.